My name is Robert Mayday, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to our forum today, Transforming Data into Policy. What can we learn from climate change policy making in Australia so far? This University of Melbourne Public Forum is sponsored by the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and the Centre for Advanced Journalism. Our audience is both numerous and diverse, befitting the current intense public interest in this topic. In particular, I'd like to welcome the people joining us online through the live webcast, and I'd like to welcome the students of Critical Thinking with Data, a breadth subject which is part of the New Melbourne model, for whom this forum is an integrated part of their studies. I'd also like to acknowledge the presence here today of both the University Provost, Professor John Dewar, and the Dean of Science, Professor Rob Saint, and thank them for their support. Climate change presents nations worldwide with complex and challenging policy dilemmas. This forum seeks to explore Australia's response to climate change, and in particular to look at support policies for trade-exposed industries and for new technologies. The forum also wants to look at how well we have used and communicated quantitative data to guide and inform both the development of policy and the broader public debate so important to its successful implementation. We're privileged today to have with us a distinguished panel, each member of which has made, within their own professional realm, important contributions to climate change policy making in this country. Our distinguished panel will be introduced by the moderator for this event, Michael Gawenda, who's the immediate past editor-in-chief of The Age and the inaugural director of the University Centre for Advanced Journalism. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael Gawenda.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's a great pleasure to be a co-sponsor for this event. I think this is the sort of event that that a university like the University of Melbourne can do so well. It's both for students and for the general public. It's about knowledge transfer. It's about the university connecting with the community. So it's a great pleasure to be involved with this event. I want to reiterate Robert's comments about the panel. I do think we have a really distinguished panel today. You couldn't get together a better group of people to discuss this most important of issues. What I'm going to do, each speaker will speak for 15 minutes. I thought we were going to have a bell, but we won't do that. The minister would be used to having a bell, but for different reasons. But we're going to try to stick to 15 minutes per speaker. After the speakers have concluded their presentations, it'll be time for questions. I'm going to reiterate this again a little later, but please, those people that ask questions rather than make statements. If you make statements, I will cut you off. The point of this forum is for you to hear what our distinguished panel have to say on this issue. So let me just briefly introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. Ross Garnaut, of course, is one of Australia's leading economists. He is currently a Vice Chancellor's Fellow and Professorial Fellow in Economics at the University of Melbourne. His landmark Garnaut Climate Change Review has formed the basis for both the Rudd government's response to the climate change issue and for the public debate on the climate change problem and the challenges, the policy challenges that confront us in terms of dealing with climate change. Rod Sims is a director of Port Jackson Partners and has advised many boards and chief executives on a wide range of issues. He is an advisor to the Business Council of Australia on greenhouse policy issues, and great to have you with us, Rod. Greg Combe, of course, is a former long-time leader of the ACTU and he's now a rising star in the Rudd government. I think that's a fair description. Among his many other posts in the Rudd government, he was appointed Parliamentary Secretary for Climate Change in February 2009, and last month was given additional ministerial responsibilities when he was appointed Minister assisting the Minister for Climate Change and Energy Efficiency. It's great to have the Minister with us. So welcome, Greg. Paul Kelly, I don't think needs much of an introduction to this audience. He's Editor-at-Large of The Australian, and Paul is one of Australia's leading political commentators. He has been described by a former Prime Minister as one of the two most consequential political commentators in Australia in the post-war period. I would agree with that. He has been an outstanding commentator on the politics and the policy challenges of climate change, both in Australia and internationally. He is a Vice Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Melbourne, and his book, March of the Patriots, was published just recently and is well worth reading. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panel. I will now ask Ross Garnaut to lead off our speakers. Thank you, Ross.
Thanks, Michael. I'm going to talk about policy making first and climate change second. And as we do so, I think we should note that we're at a pivotal moment in Australian history. We've been through two decades of unbroken economic expansion, unprecedented in our history. Our community has high expectations of continued strong growth in living standards. And yet, we have lost the essential elements of political culture that gave us that rare period of rising prosperity. We've lost that capacity of governments to act on the basis of informed analysis of the national interest against the pressures of private interests. And it shows. We had the fastest productivity growth in our history through the 90s, a fact that the Prime Minister has recently made reference to, 2% per annum total factor productivity growth. But we've had negative total factor productivity growth since 2003. As I said in a presentation to Treasury staff 2 weeks ago, I fear that we face a disappointing decade ahead. The struggle over policy between the community interests and private interests in a capitalist democracy is as old as democracy and as old as market exchange. There were many stupid things said and written in that unipolar moment after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the United States stood alone in strategic, economic, and cultural weight. Amongst the more stupid things were the pronouncements by Fukuyama about the end of history. History had ended, he said, with the triumph of democratic capitalism. Plato, at the beginning of Western political philosophy, knew better. The democratic herd that had secured the execution of the wisest man that Plato had ever known, his teacher Socrates, could not be trusted to act wisely in the national interest. He put guardians in charge of his ideal republic, just as the Chinese Communist Party leaders have set themselves up as guardians of the People's Republic. Well, Plato was acting out of understandable motives and recent memory, but we've seen enough of non-democratic regimes to know that Plato was talking nonsense. Adam Smith knew better at the dawn of the modern market economy and before democracy. Smith feared for the capacity of business interests to rig the markets within which they operated through capture of regulatory processes. Kim Anderson Professor of Economics now at Adelaide University, and I wrote a history of Australian protection policy about 25, 30 years ago. And we wrote it as a history of struggle between national and private interests, with private interests winning to the extent that they became highly influential in articulation of the national interest. The rest is history. Australia's long downward slide from being the richest country in the world at the beginning of our federation to well down the list of developed countries after eight decades was recorded in Kim and my book, and it's now well known. If the history of Australian protection policy had ended in 1983, it would tell a sorry story of the capacities of our democracy. But history did not end then. The next 17 years, the last sixth of the 20th century, represented a triumph of policymaking in the national interest over private interests. It greatly expanded the role of sound data and analysis in economic policymaking. The public was never persuaded by information and analysis. The opinion polls said consistently, before and after the removal of protection, that Australians loved protection and didn't want to lose any of it. But the spread of information, the results of analysis, public education, made it possible for the government to be recognised as acting in the national interest when it took strong decisions that weren't supported by the opinion polls. The change in political culture in that period extended to the national interest capturing private interests. Private interests, if they wished to be influential, had to place their arguments in a wide context of sound analysis of the national interest and argue them publicly. And an example of that was the role the Business Council played in the discussion of tax reform in the late 90s, where they recognised to get things they wanted, like the goods and services tax, they had to put that in the context of a broader policy that included a lot of things that seen in isolation, damaged business interests. That was a radical change from the way business lobby groups had worked in the first eight decades of our federation, and I'm afraid it's radically different from the behaviour of business groups today. I must confess that I myself shared some of Fukuyama's flawed triumphalism at the turn of this millennium. In my opening address to the first of what has become a series of famous conferences jointly organised by the Melbourne Institute and the Australian newspaper, I told the story of 20th century Australian economic policy as a wheel that had turned full circle from fairly free trade to high protection to a stable resting place in fairly free trade again. Well, the wheel has kept on turning. Australian political economy has returned to type. This seems to be part of a wider story in the established industrial countries, although the story of the continued turn of the wheel is more pronounced in Australia because we had gone further than other countries in protecting the role of the national interest in economic policy. David Llewellyn Smith and I recently published a book on the great crash of 2008, the financial crisis, and I'll just read out a few paragraphs about what we said there about the relative roles of the public interest and national interest in a democracy. I'm quoting from the book. The haunting question raised by the financial crisis is whether a United States government that is committed to effective action that damages some corporate interests is free to pursue policies that it judges to be in the national interest. The experience of the European Union and Australia on climate change policy is not reassuring. Powerful vested interests are resisting the policy reform necessary to tackle climate change, just as they resisted financial regulation policy. Will the interaction of distorted incentive structures and regulatory capture be as damaging for climate change policy as it was for financial policy? Perhaps, but political communities in all countries are much more deeply engaged with climate change than they were with financial regulation. This creates an opportunity for autonomy for any government that seeks to use it. In financial policy, the future of democratic capitalism will hinge on the capacity of governments to act independently of vested interests. With climate change, the future of human civilization is probably at stake. Well, a little bit about the national interest in climate change policy. It was my privilege, and mostly at the time my pleasure, to have been asked by then Leader of the Opposition, Kevin Rudd, and all of the state premiers and the two territory chief ministers of Australia to undertake a review of Australia's interest in climate change policy. And one thing that I had a very strong team working in that group, secretariat at first in the Victorian Premier's Department, strong group from a number of the state public services, a strong group of consultants, the leading climate scientists of Australia, and leading economists with interest in these matters, including economic modellers, joined when Mr. Rudd became Prime Minister by a Canberra component of the Secretariat, including the modelling strength of the Australian Treasury. The climate change review put Australia's effort into an international context because that is the only context that makes sense to avoid major damage from climate change, there has to be an effective global effort involving all of the substantial economies, and all of the developed countries at least will have to play a proportionate part, along with all of the developing countries of substantial size. I calculated in the report what Australia's proportionate part in a strong international effort would be, and that would require a 25% reduction in emissions from 2000 levels by 2020 and a 90% reduction by 2050. I recognise that in the absence of effective global cooperation, Australia's own efforts would not have substantial effects, and so we had to calculate efforts in that circumstances according to what Australian efforts would contribute to the eventual emergence of an effective agreement. A strong global agreement would provide a basis for international trade in emissions entitlements, and it would be much cheaper for the world as a whole, and particularly for Australia, if there were a basis for trade in entitlements so that reduction in emissions could go further in places where it was cheaper. And that would allow more ambitious global mitigation. In the review, I set out in some detail an approach to emissions reduction that would achieve Australia's part of global objectives at minimum cost. And there were two essential requirements in policy. One was to have a price on carbon, which if the world was working towards an effective outcome, would not be a low price, and it would be rising over time at the interest rate. And the second essential component of policy was support, subsidies, if you like, public support for research, development and commercialization of low emission technologies. This was necessary because you don't get enough innovation if you rely entirely on private markets, especially when innovation has to proceed at a rapid rate, as it has to in this area of technological change, if we are to achieve strong outcomes. And I saw the major commitment to funding low emissions technologies being funded from part of the revenue from auctioning all of the permits from the emissions trading scheme, which I thought was the best way of putting a price on carbon. I did note that a carbon tax was an alternative approach that had some merits, that it actually had a lot of similarities with a clean emissions trading scheme. The differences between the two tended to be exaggerated. On balance, I came down for Australia, but not for all countries, in favour of the emission trading scheme. Well, the discussion of this report and other independent analyses of Australia's interest in climate change has been one strand of the public policy discussion. But there's been another powerful strand, and that's been the pressing of interest from Australian and international companies operating in Australia that were large emitters of greenhouse gases. And the second strand has evolved in its focus over time. Companies which have been large emitters of greenhouse gases have been very well organised from the beginning. And this is a characteristic of the organisation of vested interests in the policy-making process. The people who are damaged by structurally necessary reform are usually concentrated, usually know very clearly who they are, and find it easy to mobilise resources and to organise to resist change. And for a while, these interests went through a process of denial of the science, or at least arguing a denial of the science. Then through a period of arguing that uncertainty about the science justifies delay. As I show in my report, uncertainty about the science actually increases the urgency of action because things might turn out to be worse than you expected, just as they may turn out to be better than you expect. And then we went through a period of saying, well, we should be doing something now, but we shouldn't act until others act. And then once public opinion on the matter became so influential in the electoral process, these groups began to focus on making sure that whatever was done, they did not pay any of the adjustment cost. Right through the discussion, there's been tension between ideas about the national interest, analysis of the national interest, information about the national interest, and pressures from vested interests. And the situation we've got to is very much the confluence of these forces. The private interests have acted genuinely privately, have not sought to debate the issues publicly, and have had very strong and clear and ready access to the main ministers responsible for policy and their departments. There has not been similar access for interests that might be seen as representing the public interest. I've already gone on too long, but I would contest that the unhappy circumstances of current Australian policy is very much the result of government having not got on top of the process of managing the role of private interests in our democratic discussion on this issue. That's partly the result of the continued turn of the wheel since the end of the century. It partly reflected in a more broad change in Australian political culture, but the particular history of this issue has been particularly constraining. And looking ahead, the continued strong community interest in strong action on climate change is surprising, given the absence of political leadership from anywhere in the political spectrum on such a complex issue. But it continues to provide a basis for action for a government that wished to reach over the heads of private interests to the national interest. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ross. Now I'd like to introduce Rod Sims.
Thanks very much. I've got a slightly different take on some of these things to Ross, who I've talked about these things with for many years, but of course it'd be a dull old forum if we all were in violent agreement. I have to start by saying it's just terrific to be back at Melbourne University. I graduated from this place in 1972. It's not really that long ago. Now, look, the climate change process is, I think, really genuinely worthy of study for the obvious reasons, but also because the process has still got a very long way to go. And so we do need to learn from it. In the climate change process, we've had the various IPCC reports. They reach the view with sort of 90% assurance that significant climate change is being caused by man-made greenhouse gases, and that the consequences of this range from the highly uncomfortable to the catastrophic. While there's a lot of uncertainty around the science, there's clearly more than enough evidence to start acting to deal with the problem. So in my view, the science is not really the issue. To avoid taking action on climate change, you've not just got to doubt the science, you've got to actually think it's clearly wrong. Because really this is we're acting on the basis of a precautionary principle. So unless you think, the only reason you wouldn't act is if you think the science is dead wrong, and I think there's very few people in that camp. On the economics of it, we've had a lot of reviews, among them the Stern Review, and then I think much better the Garnaut Review. These largely took a medium to long-term view, and said that the economy-wide costs of taking action to limit greenhouse gases were modest. You then had the equation of a significant risk of very bad consequences, which could be removed at modest economic cost. The argument for taking action, therefore, was to just about everybody fairly compelling. So what has happened in Australia? My answer falls under two broad headings, one to do with the targets we've set, the other with the transition phase. I think both are relevant to our topic today of turning data into policy. In fact, my thesis today is that we've had a clash between a public perception of a very easy target and costless action to achieve it, running into the reality, which I think is clearly understood by public policy professionals, particularly in Canberra, and the relevant politicians, of actually a fairly tough target and significant immediate economic and political, and so political costs associated with meeting it. This has contributed, in my view, to quite a distorted public debate. Let me explain. In relation to the targets, as we all know, both sides of Australian politics have adopted the interim target of a 5% absolute cut in emissions by 2020 on the basis that the world is not taking concerted action. As the media constantly tell us, this is a pathetically small target and so very easy to reach. In my view, both propositions are factually wrong. The 5% absolute reduction target from 1990 or 2000 levels, which Australia has adopted in the absence of concerted world action, indeed comes straight from Ross's review. In that review, Ross argued that it would be easier to get the developing world on board with climate action if the targets were set in per capita terms. Australia's 5% absolute target reduction actually represents a 25% reduction in per capita terms and over a 30% reduction in business as usual terms. And remember, by 2020. I've pointed out elsewhere that Australia's 5% absolute cut is a larger reduction than Europe's commitment of an absolute cut of 20% when both are considered in per capita terms. That means that, all else equal, the average Australian will do more to meet our minus 5% target than the average European will to meet their minus 20% target. I recently heard a representative of the building industry at a conference claim that green buildings alone could achieve the government's 5% cut. Wrong. Green buildings, on her arithmetic, would reduce the business as usual growth in emissions from 30% to 25%. A useful step, but only that. I have to say, as I've said privately to a number of politicians, that I'm amazed that the current government keeps talking of a 5% cut and so keeps reinforcing the media image that it's a pathetically small cut, rather than using the 25% per capita target as recommended by Ross in this, what he calls the waiting period, and of course, as well as observing that this is a 30% cut in business as usual terms. Perhaps the government does not want to scare the voters. In relation to transition, the transition issues, I think the issues are at least as profound. It's true that if Australia takes significant action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then the standard living we would otherwise achieve by 2050 will simply take a year or two longer. And when you chart the two lines of our living standards over time, there's very little difference. It actually doesn't matter. All true, but in my view, quite misleading. I could show the economic cost of 10% of the Australian workforce digging holes and filling them in again, and I'm not making a parallel, I'm just making a different point. And that would show that our standard living that we should achieve by 2050 might take us till 2060 to achieve. Not too big a price to pay. It's just an awkward, I think, a misleading way of looking at economic costs. The problem is we have to focus on the immediate economic costs as well, both for economic reasons as well as political reasons. As one example, obviously electricity prices will increase significantly with the price on carbon, particularly to meet the 25% per capita target by 2020. Now, the Australian economy is in many ways built on low-cost electricity, courtesy of brown and black coal, as we all know. But coal-fired electricity has high carbon intensity. Now, electricity prices are already rising significantly from a range of non-carbon issues. So an initial increase from the price on carbon will hurt, both economically and politically. We're told we should simply move to wind and solar power and thereby create jobs. This is simplistic. Electricity produced from wind costs 2 to 3 times what it costs from coal. From solar power, it costs over 6 times. And of course, the more important issue is they're both intermittent sources of power. Let me be clear, I'm not arguing we shouldn't move away from coal-fired power. I'm simply saying we've got to understand the costs and the difficulties rather than underplay them. As a second example, let's focus on the trade-exposed emission-intensive industries. Many media and other commentators argue that we should not assist them in the transition. To do so would simply take us back to the bad old days of high tariff and protectionism. Again, extremely misleading and I think simplistic, both economically and politically. Trade-exposed and emission-intensive industries are not making high profits because of a lack of carbon price. Yet a carbon price of $20 to $30, rising as it will to much higher levels to meet a 25% per capita target in reduction in emissions, would cause some industrial facilities to close fairly quickly without any compensation, and a significant loss of profits to many others. This occurs simply because most of the countries from which we import or against which we compete when we're exporting are not currently intending to put a price on carbon. We would import much more of our cement or steel rather than make it locally, simply because Australia has a carbon price while our main competitors do not. Let me be clear again. This isn't a problem that's going to matter much in the decades ahead. I don't want to exaggerate the economic harm that will ultimately be caused to the Australian economy. I have no problem with the long-term economic analysis. But the immediate effect on some companies and some employees will be severe. Why not, therefore, provide them with transitional assistance that disappears when our main competitors also impose a price on carbon. Now, Ross in his review recognised this issue, and he proposed a mechanism to address it, to provide a transitional form of assistance. The government's also recognised this issue and proposed another mechanism to address it. Both mechanisms disappear when our main competitors impose a price on carbon, and so the assistance is truly transitional by everybody's understanding. Ross is very critical of the government's form of assistance versus the mechanism he devised. As I've told him privately, I don't actually think it matters much in the scheme of things, as long as we move ahead. Indeed, rather than compare different transitional assistance schemes, we could, if we wanted to, look at different forms of emissions trading schemes. The approach advocated by Jeff Carmody would see a consumer-based scheme rather than a producer-based one. The point of carbon pricing would be the consumer and not the producer. The price of cement would increase not just on domestically produced cement, but also on imported cement. Carmody's scheme avoids the problem faced by trade-exposed and emission-intensive industries, and so avoids the debate over the transitional assistance schemes. There are issues, however, not least being the form of the border taxes on imports. To repeat my thesis of today, for today, I believe we've had a clash between the public perception of an easy target and costless action to achieve it, running into the reality of a tough target with significant immediate economic and political costs to achieve it. Now, what's that caused? The problem is that the government's proposed emissions trading scheme has tried to deal with this clash, and because of the clash, been widely criticised from all sides, in my view, largely unfairly. For example, people have criticised the 25% per capita reduction target. They only hear about it as a 5% target, which the media keeps describing as very small. They ignore the promise to match any world carbon reduction effort. In my view, the government's policy framework can allow us to deliver any share of our world, of Australia's share of any world agreement. Another criticism people make on the other side, as I say, the criticism's coming from all sides, is that prices will rise, sometimes significantly. Well, yes, that's what happens when you put a price on carbon. No surprise. Some say Australia's competitiveness will be adversely affected. Well, yes, it will. You're putting a price on carbon. Our competitiveness is based on that. But the government is providing some form of transitional compensation, which I think helps address that issue. Big business is accused, as indeed it just was, of getting a big handout and returning to the old days of protectionism. In my view, that is a misreading of the situation. Lastly, what I find the strangest allegation of all is that people say the ETS won't reduce emissions. Well, it's got to. It's a cap and trade scheme, for goodness sake. Its very design sees emissions reduced to meet any nominated target. There's no question the mechanism can work. You can argue about the emission reduction of a carbon tax. You can't argue about the emission reduction of a cap and trade scheme. To me, then, it's not surprising that a largely friendless scheme that's been criticised from every side of the political spectrum and the policy spectrum didn't get through Parliament. As I've said, this was the outcome of a clash between false expectations and the underlying political reality. So where to from here? Worldwide emissions are growing very quickly, courtesy of large developing country growth, and therefore it is getting harder for the world to meet any given part per million target. We do need, very quickly, an agreement that brings the developed and developing countries together. But unfortunately, the USA in particular seems rather distracted at this time with other policy priorities. In Australia, we still have the debate about how far to move in the absence of concerted world approach. We could impose an interim carbon tax, but unless that level is very low, we will still face issues in relation to the trade-exposed emission-intensive industries. A carbon tax doesn't make that issue go away. We could shift to a consumption-based approach with border taxes, but that will put us at odds with the production-based approach being taken in all the world forums. It is, however, a way to put a price on carbon with reduced effects on our competitiveness. Most of all, we need to understand that this is a global issue. I once heard a very senior government minister say that the Great Barrier Reef was headed for destruction unless Australia reduced its emissions. He should have added that that will only work if Australia's actions help convince the rest of the world to follow our lead. Only a reduction in world emissions will make any effective difference to the Barrier Reef. In addition, I think only a scheme that's based on practical realities is going to be an example for others to follow. The Australian Prime Minister and the Climate Change Minister, I think, have played a vital and time-consuming role in all the international forums and probably got insufficient credit for all the effort they've put in. I believe that's time very well spent, even if it has distracted them from the addressing an Australian audience. Australia does need to press ahead with putting a price on carbon. That's the key point. We've got to do so understanding its effects and bringing the community along with us. In my view, policy is all about heading in the right direction. It's not about perfection, it's about making a start. We would have an ETS as law now if the Greens had voted for it last year. They argued that the ETS was inadequate, so they preferred no action to what they deemed as inadequate action. As time moves on and the problems become more urgent, people will be more prepared to act. But if, however, people such as the Greens keep putting demands beyond what can be politically delivered, we will get nowhere. You can only climb a ladder if you put your foot on the first rung. Once on the ladder, you can go up as quickly as you like. It's a lousy analogy, but the best I could do. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Rod. Our next speaker is the Minister, Greg Combe. Greg, welcome.
Thanks very much, Michael. I'm the politician on the panel, something that surprises me still from time to time. I guess I should declare a few other things about my background, though. Firstly, my role in the government. I assist Senator Penny Wong, who is the Minister for Climate Change and Energy Efficiency, and I was appointed to that role a bit over 12 months ago, so that I've worked on the emissions trading scheme arrangements as they've been submitted to Parliament and go through the parliamentary debate and the public political debate that's occurred over the last 15 months or so, and also done a lot of work in negotiations with industry that's been referred to by both Ross and Rod, and I'll come back to that issue in a little while. But I also bring various other experiences, I guess, to the role that I've played in relation to climate change policy within the government. Firstly, these are declarations of interests I'm about to make. Firstly, I'm a qualified coal mining engineer, although it's a long time since I've worn a hard hat in a coal mine. I do bring that experience with me and some understanding of how the industry operates and how an emissions trading arrangement might impact upon coal and many other areas. I also studied economics at the University of Sydney, which has had an influence, obviously, on how I approach public policy issues. And I was very fortunate to study under Professor Ted Wheelwright, who some of you may be aware of, but who I think, to put it in the parlance of the time, was regarded as an institutional economist, and that is he spent a lot of time analysing the influence of institutions on public policy making and on how the economy operated. And Professor Garnaut's contribution earlier, I think, in many respects fits well within that type of framework of analysis, and I bring that to my public policy work as well. That is, in particular, the influence of large corporations, for example, on public policy making. Thirdly, I guess I was a union official for many years, as some of you may be aware of, and the leader of the ACTU for 10 years or so during the period of the Howard government. And I'm also very familiar with how external parties, that is external to the parliament, might try and go about influencing public policy, because that was a critical part of my role. And I'm acutely conscious of the pressure of external interests and public policy making as a consequence. Finally, in my declarations, I suppose, I'm also a federal member of parliament for a seat within the Hunter Valley. There's about 12 coal mines in my electorate. 25% of the New South Wales baseload power is generated in my electorate, and the rest of it very close by. There are two aluminium smelters within the Hunter Valley, which are very high consumers of electricity, of course, and profoundly impacted upon by the implementation of a carbon price in the economy. And I can't help but, as a representative of people in that region and in my specific electorate, of course, be conscious, be otherwise than conscious about many of the economic and social issues that emissions trading might throw up. Now, having declared all of that, because I think it is important you understand where I come from personally, in that's my pleasure, Rod. Particularly the mining part, you might agree.
These people are trying to study.
Yes.
It is important to ask, what is the degree of accuracy of figures? And your kind of thing is very important.
Oh, thank you. That's fine, but thank you for that. But it is extremely pertinent to how you approach public policy formulation, your own experience, and the way in which, of course, it's not a determinative thing at the end of the day if you're a minister in the government, but it is very important, the perspective that you take to it. So in coming into the portfolio, of course, I was acutely conscious of the work that Professor Garnaut had done at the request of the then opposition leader, Kevin Rudd, and the state and territory leadership that Ross pointed to. Ross may not appreciate this, but in fact he's had immense and profoundly important influence on the way in which public policy has been formulated in response to climate change. And it's been an extremely important contribution. In assessing the data, having a look at the economic issues in particular and how it may operate in our economy, and on what approach government should take in international fora to deal with climate change, Professor Garnaut's review has been extremely influential in public policy making. So too, of course, have been the various contributions to the climate science. The IPCC report, some of you may be familiar with, although the subject of various criticism over recent months for particular aspects, nonetheless remains the work of many, many climate scientists internationally that has been peer-reviewed work. And the criticisms that have been made do not, from the government's point of view nor my personal point of view, derogate in significant ways from the findings of the IPCC assessments, the most recent one being the fourth assessment. In more recent times, you may be familiar with, for example, that the CSIRO has considered the climate science issues and how it might impact upon us, and the head of the CSIRO said recently, Megan Clark, that climate change is real. And I state this because this is still a contested issue in the public policy debate. Climate change is real. Our records, that is the CSIRO, shows there's no disputing that, and that the next step is to meet this challenge through mitigation and adaptation to the effects of climate change. Some of the statistics that the CSIRO adverted to in that report recently is that Australia has warmed significantly over the last 50 years, and this is also data that's been assessed and supplied by the Bureau of Meteorology. So we've warmed over the last 50 years. Some areas have experienced a warming of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius over that period. That is significant. 2009 was in fact our second hottest year on record and finished off the hottest decade in Australian history, that is European recorded history with respect to weather. Each decade, a further finding of the CSIRO in this study since the 1940s has been warmer than the preceding decade. And I don't know if it's an argument that needs to be made in this forum, but from the government's standpoint, the climate science is clear, and once that is accepted by a government, there is a responsibility to act upon that information and to formulate an appropriate public policy response. The findings are telling us that carbon emissions are contributing to climate change and that they are human-induced carbon emissions that are making that contribution. Ergo, a public policy response, as detailed in Professor Garnaut's report and many others, needs to contemplate how we can abate the level of our carbon emissions. A question then, of course, immediately emerges. This is an international phenomenon. a country that generates about 1.4%, I think the figure is, of international carbon pollution or the greenhouse gas emissions in our own economy, to what extent can we in fact influence the course of or the effect of climate change globally? Well, the answer is, firstly, as the previous speakers have stated, you have a responsibility to take steps in your own economy, particularly when we're the highest per capita emitter in the advanced economies. We have a responsibility to deal with the issue. And we have a responsibility, furthermore, to do that as part of an international response. And so the government, upon election in 2007, of course, one of the first major international fora that the Prime Minister attended with Senator Wong was the Bali conference to map out where to in relation to a successor agreement following the Kyoto Protocol. And that, of course, culminated in the Copenhagen conference last year, which, of course, disappointed in its outcomes. Now, those are extremely important framework within which to understand, I think, the whole of the public policy debate about climate change in this country. It must be done in an international context, but we have a responsibility ourselves to the science, to act upon it and to abate our own levels of emissions. In formulating a public policy response, therefore, the government did a lot of work that I won't advert to here. We can go through it a bit further if you're interested when we're in the question period. However, essentially, it is evident, of course, that the most important thing, and to mitigate, if you like, the economic cost of adjustment, is to come up with the most economically efficient mechanism for reducing carbon pollution in our atmosphere, and to do that in a way that it can interface with international efforts, that it is credible, and that it can also benefit from steps that are taken internationally. The short story of that outcome, as Professor Garnaut adverted to earlier, is that an emissions trading scheme is the most economically efficient way of going about reducing carbon emissions. It puts a carbon price into the economy and ultimately affects investment decisions, therefore. Simple thing, if you just think about a coal-fired electricity generator, when you bring in an emissions trading arrangement, which we call the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, the electricity generator has an obligation to purchase a permit for every tonne of carbon dioxide equivalent that it emits into the atmosphere. Immediately, that imports a cost within the electricity generator, and that cost is passed through into the rest of the economy, consumers of electricity, both commercially and domestically. It changes behaviour. One thing immediately is for the electricity generator itself, now finds itself in a position where the external cost to the environment of the pollution that it produces now has a price, whereas it hasn't had previously. It changes the thinking of the investors in electricity generation. Immediately, the power station in my electorate, immediately with the prospect of the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme coming into law, started to look for ways of improving their efficiency and reducing their emissions per unit of output of electricity, simply because a carbon price was going to come into the economy. And they got to work on that and found a significant degree of efficiency that they are already enacting. Many other sectors of the economy start to do the same thing. It provides an incentive to start to improve the efficiency at an industrial level and an energy level that helps to abate carbon emissions because it's bringing a price in. It immediately, Rod was saying, some of the relative costs of solar power generation or wind power, etc. Currently, coal-fired electricity is a relatively cheap source of energy in this country, and we haven't priced the externality of its carbon emissions. Once you start to do that and a carbon price starts to come into the electricity that's generated by the coal-fired electricity sources, it makes investment decisions in alternative energy sources more rational to make from an investor standpoint. Banks start to think, well, what's the future of energy generation in this country? Should we be, instead of investing in new coal-fired electricity generation, be looking at gas-fired electricity generation? Because in the longer term, you know, the input costs of a carbon price change the investment calculus. All of those things start to happen. In the coal industry, in my own area that I mentioned before, coal mining companies immediately start to look at the level of methane gas emission from their coal mining operations and start to assess that in their future production costs. This leads to change in investment decisions that say, we've got two alternative investments on the table before the board. This investment, whilst good quality coal, also has very high levels of methane emissions. We will have to buy permits for each tonne of methane equivalent, of carbon dioxide equivalent, I should say. Changes the investment matrix because this coal over here has the same qualities for steaming or coking coal purposes, and yet has low methane levels, we'll invest there. And you achieve in the investment decision a reduction in carbon pollution that otherwise wouldn't have occurred without a carbon price. So that is the way in which it works. And because it's about where investment decisions go, particularly in the energy sector, it is most efficient to do it through an emissions trading scheme. The investment decisions are best left in the hands of people who are making them rather than by direction of government. I think that's an experience that many of us may possibly share. However, once you've crossed all that path in formulating a public policy response and accept perhaps that an emissions trading arrangement is the best public policy response, and it has the important benefit too of linking to emissions trading arrangements in other economies so that efficient abatement in another economy may be achieved and we can interface and take benefit from that as well. Once you've reached that point, of course, then you start to get into the world of what is politically realistic in a democracy such as ours, and what role do institutions play in lobbying for change and to influence public policy? Who is opposing it? Who's supporting it? Who controls the Senate? Many practical elements start to come into play, and these are profoundly important. You can have the best evidence-based policy making that you can possibly achieve, and of course all good governments aspire to do that. But we also have to deal with the practical reality of a democracy, of community attitudes, of the role and influence of external institutional players, how that influences political opinion, and in particular the makeup of the parliament and specifically the Senate. Now, for the government to get legislation through in the Senate, we need additional votes. The Labor Party, as you would be well aware, doesn't control the numbers in the Senate. Legislation can be easily defeated. Rod made the comment a moment ago about the role of the Greens, and it's a very pertinent one. The Greens voted against the carbon pollution reduction scheme legislation in the Senate multiple times. And from their point of view, it's quite legitimate to say that it's an imperfect scheme, that it's been influenced by business, by industry, by electricity generators, or that it provides too much compensation to one particular sector of the economy or another. But at the end of the day, again, as Rod said, you have to make a start with these things. The government engaged widely throughout the economy and the community to devise a public policy response of an emissions trading scheme that did a number of things to try and make it a political as well as an economic reality that addressed our environmental concerns and which could operate internationally. A very challenging task. The costs that I referred to that go into the economy, particularly through increased energy prices. The government committed to make sure that low and middle income households received assistance to meet the additional household level costs. We looked at specific industries that were trade exposed to try and make sure that we provided transitional assistance that allowed for the economic adjustment to take place over time. And of course, there's been a lot of argument about this, but if I could give you one example. The aluminium smelting industry, and I mentioned that there were two in my region in the Hunter Valley, they essentially take prices for their product on the international market that's set by the London Metals Exchange. An increase in the cost of production for them in a purely export context cannot easily be passed on in higher prices without a substantial impact on their competitiveness. If their margins are tight, in particular, and they're competing against other countries which have cheaper sources of energy and which do not have a carbon price, and yet aluminium smelting is an extremely high energy user in the production process, it can have a significant impact. We made a clear decision that it would be important to provide a proportion of free permits to aluminium smelting and to many other parts of the economy, which would decay, if you like, over time. That is, the rate of support would decay over time, but which would ensure that they remained viable, that the employment in those areas would remain secure, and that there would be a capacity to adjust over time. We did a similar thing in relation to the coal industry to provide for transitional assistance and a host of other industries for which the government, of course, has been criticised. But I can say, having declared my interest earlier, so that you know, I personally and the government collectively are very committed to, because we believe that we need to make a start in reducing carbon pollution, importing a carbon price into the economy, and doing it in a way which is sensitive to our economic structure, and transitioning in specific industries that are trade exposed overseas when there is not a carbon price internationally, to ensure that we make that adjustment in an appropriate way over time. Now, we got very close at the end of the day, having done all of that work, to enacting the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, as you may recall. During the course of last year, the fact of the matter is that I think it was evident that the only way that it could be prosecuted through the Senate at that time was through agreement with the Coalition, and specifically the Liberal Party, which would have given the capacity to carry the legislation through. It would also have had a very important benefit of having a bipartisan response to a major, our most significant economic and environmental threat and challenge, and given the community and the business community confidence that both sides of politics in the Australian democracy were committed to this policy response. And as you may recall, we secured an agreement with Malcolm Turnbull as opposition leader, and it cost him his job. And at the end of the day, you'll recall that I made a remark earlier, and that is that if you accept the science, you have to take responsibility for a public policy response if you're in Parliament. And Malcolm Turnbull, to his credit, took that responsibility, but it cost him the leadership of the opposition. And of course, the opposition is now led by Tony Abbott, a fantastic triathlete. I'm in awe. He's a year older than me. God knows how he manages to do that, and particularly with a demanding job. So I certainly respect his capacity to do these things, but I don't respect his position on climate change. I think it's opportunist, and I think it's enormously destructive. And I think he did it as a mechanism to grab control of the opposition. He was successful in that regard. I think he's played to fears and concerns in the community that now make it a very even more significant political challenge to take proper action and public policy responses to climate change. But it'll certainly ensure that this is going to continue to be a very vigorous public policy debate. The science will be further examined and debated. Emissions trading will be further examined and debated. Support for consumers, support for industry, transitional arrangements, all of the public policy aspects will continue to be the subject of debate. I suppose what I can say to you in conclusion is that I believe that the policy, with all of its ins and outs and ups and downs, and the way in which it's been influenced by all of the factors that we've all adverted to, is an appropriate response for this country. The government remains very committed to it. It's going to inevitably be a continuing issue. This is an election year. It will be an issue that will be discussed in the lead up to the election. I look forward to the result with hope and optimism. But I think if I could leave you with this message, it is very important that political leadership takes responsibility and acts responsibly. And I don't believe we're seeing that from the opposition in relation to this issue. You won't be surprised to hear me say that, but I, in fact, deeply believe that to be the case. This is a challenge that requires a responsible public policy debate and response across politics in this country. And I think if we can continue to commit to that, try and work towards it, the thing that will make it happen is the community itself. Politicians respond to community attitudes at the end of the day, and that's appropriate in a democracy. And I'd invite you to make that clear if you think that action needs to be taken, to make that clear to all parties in this argument. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Minister. Last but by no means least, we have Paul Kelly. Paul?
Thanks, Michael. I know we're running a bit behind time, so I'll tighten up the comments I intend to make. The heart of our tribulations lie in confused perceptions of the public interest. That's what I want to talk about today and make 4 points about the public interest in relation to science, politics, equity, and economics. The entire issue depends upon science. This demands the most professional and balanced scientific assessments. The correct response from political leaders is to act upon the majority scientific findings, while recognise that uncertainties characterise this debate. The Garnaut report said, and I quote, "There is great uncertainty about climactic outcomes of varying concentrations of greenhouse gases, about the impacts of various climate change outcomes, about the costs and effectiveness of mitigation in Australia." That's a lot of uncertainty. There are, in fact, two ways to present the science. First, that the science is settled. Second, that the issue depends upon the balance of probability. The second formulation is unattractive to media and politicians who favour action, and I understand that. However, the polarised debate between stereotypes of believers and sceptics does not serve the public interest, nor does it encourage a sound public policy response. The historic collapse in coalition support for the Rudd government's ETS in late 2009 was not an aberration. It was the result of defects in the public debate and the political debate, and to a certain extent, a top-down, force-fed conventional wisdom. This demands a reassessment of the interaction between science and politics. Scientists and politicians need to rethink, I believe, how they present this issue. Social researcher Hugh Mackay points out the Australian public got disenchanted precisely because it felt there was too great a gap between government action on the one hand and declarations on the other about the greatest moral challenge of the age. The first paragraph of the Rudd government's white paper says, and I quote, "Climate change is the greatest social, economic and environmental challenge of our time." Many people would support that. It may or may not be true, though it's clearly not true last week because health policy was, and next week economic policy probably will be. Political leaders who invoke the Al Gore position face one of two consequences. They must either fundamentally change the policy and political priorities of their government to reflect the priority to climate change, or they will face the humiliation of not matching their rhetoric. At present, it's clear that neither option is palatable. What we require is a shift in the debate towards a more rational, less emotional, less polarising environment, where the need to take substantive policy action as an insurance policy against global warming can be actually accepted more widely. The insurance principle is vital. You don't need to be a believer to sign up. I recognise this is unlikely to happen because we have an ideological debate, and once you get an ideological debate, you get a polarised community. The second point I want to make relates to the responsibilities of government in the international political domain. Climate change is a global problem, with Australia contributing by 2030 an estimated 1.1% of global emissions. There is no Australian solution as such. As Rod Sims says, there is no Australian action that saves the Barrier Reef, only global action. This puts climate change mitigation onto an entirely different plateau from virtually any other of the great economic reforms we've seen over the last 25 years, such as the float, abolition of tariff, labour market deregulation, and tax reform. The Rudd government's response, therefore, is to promote international action to try and achieve the desired global result, to stabilise greenhouse gas emissions. This is in the public interest, and I support it. It's a conception of the public interest based upon the ideas of responsible global citizenship to protect the planet we share. Yet there is another conception of the public interest as well. This recognises that to the extent we act too much ahead of others, then we damage our economic competitiveness, the so-called prisoner's dilemma, that each country benefits by doing less of the mitigation. This is a conception of climate change mitigation based on national interest competition, and this is very important in terms of global negotiations. It's about how the burden is shared. It's exemplified by leading developing nations such as China and India refusing to accept binding monitored targets. It is about national rivalry. It's the essence of why the meeting at Copenhagen failed, where China's chief negotiator said at the end he was happy with the result. It's therefore entirely responsible for the Rudd government to say that Australia should have a proportionate response, that our own targets will depend upon what the rest of the world does, hence the three targets, 5, 15, 25% by 2020, depending upon the extent of global agreement. Note the 5% target is unconditional. It means that Australia is prepared to take some action regardless, because moving away from fossil fuel dependency is a virtue in its own right. Yet it recognises that our response should be proportionate in terms of its ambition and dependent upon the extent of global agreement. Much of the media is reluctant to accept the gravity of competing national economic interests in this debate. Yet if the world cannot get agreement on a new trade deal based on mutual benefits, there is no certainty whatsoever it can get agreement on a new and bona fide climate change treaty that does the job. Hence, I think the flexible and proportionate response of the Rudd government is consistent with the public interest. The third point I want to make relates to equity. Notably, the repeated claim that Australia's targets are inadequate or just plain hopeless. It is the gospel among Greens, NGOs, and many scientists, yet it's wrong. The fairest way to allocate national targets over time is on a per capita basis that accounts for population growth. This is also the best way to analyse burden sharing. The reluctance of Greens to accept the validity of per capita analysis is counterproductive because it is the only obvious mechanism to get high population developing nations to accept a truly global agreement. When per capita analysis is used, the Garnaut report found Australia doing more than Europe, Japan, or the United States, although you'd never read this in the Australian media. The white paper showed that Australia's 5 to 15% targets equated in per capita terms to a 34 to 41% reduction below 1990 levels, are tougher than both the US and the EU. In my view, the Rudd government has not been effective in selling this message because virtually nobody believes it. Yet per capita analysis is critical to the entire equity debate. My fourth and final point is that the unprecedented nature of climate change and the climate change problem means that the train tracks for good public policy did not pre-exist. And this was a severe difficulty. In policy terms, there are three trends at work. The first is a market-based ETS favoured by treasuries and economists around the world as the most cost-effective response. Another is a government intervention industry policy approach to achieve a 20% renewable energy target espoused by politicians, Greens, and renewable industry lobbies. And the third position, more radical, is there should be urgent intervention by governments to scale back or close down fossil fuel outlets. The tension between these three positions has been obvious for quite a period of time. And one of the problems is that it leads to extremities in the public debate. Let's look at what happened to the government's ETS in the Senate. It suffered from two problems. The first, that the perfect is the enemy of the good. The debate is riddled with this sentiment. The Greens sank the Rudd government's ETS. It wasn't pure enough for them, so we have nothing. You can count on the fingers of one hand the number of political columns that criticise them. Anybody who adopts the position of purity in this debate seems to be enshrined as a moral hero by the media. Frankly, we need to get real. The idea that the Rudd government is peddling a tokenistic scheme is strong and damaging and, I believe, misconceived. This leads, of course, to the second problem. And the second problem is exactly the reverse. The opposition says the price effect is too high, the damage to the economy is too great, the science is too doubtful, and the United States won't buy cap and trade. That is, the Rudd government's response is too strong and too irresponsible. So the government was caught on both sides of the political fence. The moral is quite clear. We need to get away from the extremes of this debate, and we need to strengthen the political centre. That is the core of the problem. It involves a reinterpretation of the public interest, a clearer debate about the public interest, a better performance by the media and the politicians to strengthen the idea of the political centre. And in particular, there are a couple of issues we need to address. The first one is the debate about pricing. Look, the public was only let into the secret far too late that a low carbon economy involves high energy prices. While there is community goodwill to assist, the limits of how much pain households are ready to endure is extremely debatable. Then we've got the great historic trade-off in this debate. Sacrifice now to deliver, on the balance of probabilities, a cleaner world for your children and grandchildren. This is a political equation democracies have never had to face before. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Paul. I think you'd all agree that we've been privileged to an hour and 20 minutes of really interesting and really challenging information. So I'd like to thank you, the panel at the stage. We are going to take some questions, and we might even run a little beyond 2 o'clock. So I'm going to start with two questions. One from that we received online, and who's going to ask that question? I think we have someone organised to ask that question.
Paul from Mitcham in Melbourne asked the panel, how bad do climate change events have to become before it becomes politically safe to take effective action to lower CO2 emissions?
I think it's already bad enough. I think it is politically safe if the government is ready to provide clear leadership.
And look, I'll just say I agree. I just think the time is... It's always the right time to put the price on carbon and get moving. The sooner we get moving, the sooner we'll make progress.
I can best offer a perspective from my previous experience, and that is that I made this remark in my address. That is, politicians, governments, oppositions, Greens and all the rest are influenced by community attitudes. And if there is a feeling in the community that the climate change events are demanding of a public policy response, please make it clear.
We now have a question, I think, from the faculty. Yes?
My name's Paul Finn, and I'm a tutor in critical thinking with data. And my question is, do you see an economic advantage for businesses to act over and above government policy to reduce their impact on climate change? And are there any industries which would not be able to make such change?
Yes, the two key policy variables that we need are a price on carbon, fairly high and rising over time, and support for innovation, for research, development and commercialisation. And it will not be in the interests of most companies to do very much other than the normal marginal profit maximising things to reduce energy use where they can until these essential policy elements are in place.
Okay, so we'll take some more questions. You'll have to line up behind the microphones on either side. Now, I don't want you all to race down. Put your hands up and I'll nominate some people where there's someone that's nominated themselves there. Wait a second. Any on this side? Do you want to go up there?
Okay.
Well, at the moment, anyone else?
Okay.
Okay, well, let's start with, this side.
Okay. There seems to be a explicit or implicit assumption among the panelists that the global economy has to continually grow. However, if you look at the global economy, what you see is a system of increasing social disparity, a growing gap.
I'm sorry, but you have to ask a question.
Oh, okay. So my question is, that this idea of ongoing economic expansion, at the end of the day, is it environmentally sustainable? Or do we need to perhaps think outside the box and think about an alternative system that is more committed to both social parity or social justice and environmental sustainability?
I don't think that we're going to get social justice or equity without rising living standards amongst the world's majority of poor people. I think that economic growth can be sustainable and is actually necessary for equity, for justice, necessary even for decline in fertility and stabilization and reduction of world population. And the challenge is not to stop rising living standards and the emergence from poverty of the 7 billion people on this earth who are too poor, but the breaking of the link between economic growth and various environmental damage in relation to climate change. My review shows that with the right policies, that could be done at reasonable cost.
I think the doomsday position is to argue that the only way you can solve the environmental problem is by reducing growth and reducing living standards. That doesn't work. That just doesn't work, and you are not going to get responsible politicians leading responsible governments adopting that position.
I completely agree with Professor Garnaut, and for the interest of time, I won't expand on it.
My name's Ian Blair. I'm a sustainability consultant. I've got two very simple questions. One, can the panel ask of having an independent source of information so that you don't have this argument? What's your solution there? And the other thing is, you haven't given enough emphasis on tax. We've got Henry's tax review coming out. Can you comment on the use of a carbon tax as part of the taxation system? And we've got within the taxation system all the mechanisms of compensation, reward, and it works in with the financial system of rewarding activity.
Well, perhaps I'll kick off with that. I made the observation that I believe to be valid, and that is that the most economically efficient way for us as an economy to reduce our carbon emissions is through an emissions trading scheme. And of course, Professor Garnaut looked in great detail at different economic mechanisms that may be used to achieve reductions in pollution and therefore environmental outcomes. The government went with the emissions trading arrangements that we've articulated, and one of the important advantages of that a carbon tax does far less efficiently is a link with international efforts as well. And we remain committed to continuing to work with other economies in the development of emissions trading arrangements over time, and we believe that would be the most efficient way internationally of reducing emissions too. It's not necessarily the case in every economy. Of course, that's how it will unfold, but that's been our position.
Can I just add that the big advantage of an ETS, which I think gets lost a lot, is that it actually allows the forward price to rise because you've got a projected decline in emissions and so the forward price increases. So if the price starts at $25 or $30, going out over 20 years, you'll be able to see it and project it very clearly going up quite quickly to call it 60, 70, whatever dollars. With a tax, it's very hard for the government. I mean, you could actually put a tax in, I guess, and legislate that it would go up. It's just not as easy to do that because you'll get a lot more dispute over how that works. I'd much rather, I mean, if you're going to cap emissions, then let's cap emissions and do it directly and let's see where the price goes rather than do it the other way around.
And I'm not quite sure, just on the political front, given the difficulty of prosecuting an emissions trading scheme with a market mechanism for pricing carbon, that putting a carbon tax through the Senate would be any easier at all.
And on the first question of the need for independent analysis to sort out difference in perspective, I think my review would pass any test of independence. The problem was that while, as Greg said, it may have been much discussed inside government, there was no discussion of the issues outside government. I think that was a source of confusion, including amongst the huge number of people who took my published work very seriously.
Hello, I'm a member of a fairly active community, and I'm just wondering whether this perceived inaction at a government level is leading to widespread community action, but maybe that's sort of detracting from the sort of the strength of nationwide efforts. I hope that makes some sense.
Well, I guess you won't be surprised if I reject the proposition that the government has been inactive. And you've heard a lot of what has gone on. We've done an enormous amount of policy development work. This is one of the most complex economic policy issues, putting aside every other element of it, environmental considerations and like that, I think has been contemplated by any government. Ross was involved in the 1980s with profoundly important economic reforms of the Hawke government. This is a hugely significant economic reform that has endeavoured to be undertaken. I think the Prime Minister deserves some credit, actually, for the role he's played internationally, because that is extremely important to addressing climate change. And the fact, I shouldn't let it go and rest here, that somehow or other the government hasn't endeavoured to advocate this. We've worked very hard to try and develop the policy and to advocate it. You can be critical of our performance, of course, but at the end of the day, what I meant by a comment that I made earlier, to make your voice known, if you're active, there will be an election this year. It is a democracy. You're going to be presented with a choice between the major political parties, one of which respects the climate science and has developed a comprehensive response to it. People may see imperfections in it, but I've described some of the reasoning why we've arrived where we have in terms of the legislation and public policy. But on the other side of this debate, unfortunately, I think, for this country, you will have advocacy that the science, to quote Tony Abbott, and I respect what Paul said about this earlier, but Tony Abbott says the climate science is absolute crap. Like, that's their starting point now. The overthrow of Malcolm Turnbull as leader of the Liberal Party is a hugely significant event because it has meant a polarity has opened up in this issue in politics and a questioning of the science and therefore a repudiation of the most economically efficient response to it. You're going to have a choice when we get around to the election this year, and when that choice is made, you need to consider, I think, all of the political parties and their positions, including the Greens and their naive, you know, idealism that prevented, you know, an effective response by the Australian government to this issue.
Well, I think individual action all helps, though. I mean, it all adds to the momentum, so that's good.
Just a couple of thoughts. For the ETS to get up at the end of the day, it's got to be underwritten by bipartisanship. The policy work done by the Rudd government is very extensive and very impressive. The Garnaut report, the Green paper, the White paper, you would normally expect this sort of policy work to end in the scheme being legislated. The reason the scheme wasn't legislated at the end of the day was because there was not sufficient political support. There was a political problem, and the political problem remains. And the political problem is a function of defects in the debate. The change of position
by the opposition came from the grassroots. It came upwards from the grassroots. It came essentially from the base of the coalition. 5 weeks before Abbott became Liberal Party leader, he was supporting Turnbull and wanted the ETS to pass. The reason he changed his mind was overwhelmingly because of grassroots sentiment inside the coalition. Now, that's got to be addressed. That is a problem when it comes to public opinion in terms of achieving a bipartisan support for an ETS.
I think we can look with rosy glasses about bipartisanship in the past. On the major economic reforms of the 80s and 90s, bipartisanship came mainly after the reform. The significant exception was that brief fightback period where the opposition got ahead of the government, which made it easier for the government to accelerate a number of changes. But on a very large number of other issues, they were fiercely contested at the time. The bipartisanship came after a political victory and the bedding down of change.
Well, that's certainly right in many cases, Ross, but the point is the government hasn't legislated its scheme. The government is not able to put together a sufficient cross-party majority to legislate its scheme. And the question is, how does it do this in this parliament or, in fact, in the next parliament? So there has to be a degree of bipartisanship to get this through the parliament.
Thanks. I'd like to shift the attention to the international arrangements for a little while. The Copenhagen Accord allowed for countries to make commitments to emission reduction targets, which they've started to do, but they're emerging in many different ways, different baseline years, different types of target setting in terms of percentage emission reductions against that baseline year or against
GDP per capita.
So my question is, do we have a framework within that that provides for an international regime, an international trading regime with all these different targets? A number of people have argued for per capita emission arrangements to apply. Would that be a better arrangement, and how do we get there?
No, we don't have a sound basis for international trade in entitlements. Actually, what developing countries in particular put on the table as domestic commitments are far-reaching, adding up to what I expected of them, of developing countries as a whole, as their proportionate part in an ambitious global agreement. Developed countries haven't gone so far. And the big question mark, of course, is the United States. But China's gone significantly beyond in domestic commitments to what I attribute to them as a proportionate effort in a global agreement. I think that they will implement that. But the absence of a clear and principled allocation of entitlements across countries, that type of binding agreement, means that we don't have a firm basis for international trade, which is why I said that if that's the outcome of Copenhagen, we'll be in a waiting game, and I recommended in the review that in those circumstances we should legislate the ETS and fix the price, fix it as a rising price, and I've got formulae in the report, until such time as there is a basis for international agreement. It's not true other countries aren't doing anything. China in the aluminium, steel, cement industries, the ones that Rod is worried about international competition, doing far more than we are contemplating. South Africa has a carbon tax, a developing country. Its aluminium smelters competing with ours pay a carbon tax. Indonesia, Brazil taking major steps. They don't have an ETS, don't have our sort of price. Because of that, they're imposing probably higher costs on the industries that are affected. In my formula for support for trade-exposed industries, I said, let's measure these things. Let's do some real calculations so that so that support for the trade-exposed industries doesn't come out the back of a pork barrel, but is based on objective calculation. And that's really the difference between myself and the government and Rod on support for trade-exposed industries.
Well, I think we've certainly got time for one more question. We'll
Greg
see.
Greg Hunt from the South East Council's Climate Change Alliance. And I've got a question for Greg Combe. I'm prepared to accept that the Rudd government has done a lot of work on the policy development here, but at the moment the public debate is left very much to, say, Paul's newspaper, The Australian, leading the charge for the deniers. Might we see government money, which is fairly freely spread around on telling us how good the government is, might we see some of that government money actually leading a public campaign to get the science into people's minds and to see how an ETS is a good and appropriate response to that?
Well, if you're applauding government spending on advertising, that's welcome. However, in my former work at the ACT, I actually took a high court case against the Howard government over government advertising, and it was an issue that was very strongly felt by my colleagues in the Rudd government, and we took a number of steps to ensure that government advertising was specifically related to program implementation and delivery, for example, and we remain very committed to that. I think this is an issue that I think is pretty well entrenched in community debate and discussion. That's why I keep adverting to the fact I think we've got an election this year, and it will be an election issue. It's a very important challenge facing us. We can't be held as a nation to follow Paul's analysis of what took place in the coalition. We cannot as a nation afford to be held captive to a very, very tiny number of people who are active Liberal Party members who informed the decision of Tony Abbott and Nick Minchin and others to change the leadership of the coalition and to take a different stance on this question. So I think the community debate about it needs to broaden and deepen. Yes, of course, I accept and respect responsibility on behalf of government to lead and participate in that and to articulate our position, and that is what we shall do. But ultimately, this is a democracy. It's very important that people inform themselves about the issues and in particular not operate off talkback radio analysis of climate science, but do what you can to inform yourselves, as obviously many of you do so, and engage in community discourse about it. Community level activism and organisations such as ourselves are very, very important, I think, in extending this discussion, making sure that people understand what is a very complex problem and challenge, and which is a very complex level of issues that need to be engaged in from a policy standpoint. And if I could just conclude on this comment, can you think of many other circumstances where we've been confronting an international environmental challenge with all of the diversity of the different economies, societies and governments around the world that requires all of them to act in this way, in a coherent manner to address the issue and to take what are difficult policy and political and economic measures within their own economies? It is a very difficult challenge, and one which demands that people do debate it and discuss it, support the organisations in society, if that is your view, that are proposing to take responsible action in relation to it, and make sure that those who aren't proposing to take responsible action, I know you expect this from a politician from the Labor Party with our policy position, but I frankly think it is completely unacceptable for political leadership in this country to say that the science is absolute crap. I think it's completely unacceptable. It betrays the national interest. And I think it's also unacceptable to engage in, you know, conspiracy theories about why this is all occurring at an international level. Look at the science, understand what the policy challenges are and the responses that are necessary, and express your support in a democracy for the responses that are proposed.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up at this point on that clearly non-partisan, non-political answer that we got from the Minister. I think you'll agree that we've had a most informative and challenging forum. I hope you all enjoyed it. I want you now to join with me to thank again our panellists, Ross Garnaut, Rod Sims, Greg Combe and Paul Kelly. Thank you.